Hello everyone, and welcome to Cure Talks for a discussion on multiple myeloma. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Talks, joining you from India. And I wish everyone here a very happy new year. This is Cure Talks' 76th episode, and we have a new website now. Please do visit us at www.curetalks.com. And do send in your feedbacks to me, Priya, at trialx.com. We are discussing European perspectives on myeloma treatment strategies, and we have with us on our myeloma broadcast today one of the foremost myeloma specialists in the world, Dr. Antonio Palumbo from University of Torino. Welcome to the show, Dr. Palumbo. It's an honor to have you here.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
My co-host for the show is myeloma survivor and editor of MyelomaSurvival.com, Gary Peterson. On the panel are myeloma advocates and survivors Pat Killingsworth, Jack Aiello, and Lucy Smith. Gary Peterson will introduce us to our expert and begin with the discussion. Before I hand over to Gary, I would like to tell all listeners that we will be addressing questions sent in towards the end of the show. And if you have a question for our panel, you can press 1 on your keypad and we will bring you on air to ask your question. Alternately, you can email me with your question at priya@trialx.com. With that, it's over to Gary. Gary, you're on air.
All right, thank you again, Priya, and thank you for putting together this wonderful forum for all the patients to be able to learn of some of the best new news and existing procedures in multiple myeloma. Dr. Antonio Palumbo is the chief of the myeloma unit of the Department of Oncology, Division of Hematology at the University of Torino. Dr. Palumbo was a research associate at the Wister Institute, University of Pennsylvania. He specializes in hematology, malignancies, medical oncology, and has clinical and research interest in plasma cell dyscrasia, whatever that is. I didn't Google that, so.
No, that's okay.
Dr. Palumbo's MD received his doctor's degree from the University of Torino in Italy, served his residency in internal medicine, and held a fellowship in hematology oncology at the University of Torino. He is a member of the board of directors of the International Myeloma Society, of the advisory board of International Myeloma Foundation, the IMF, president of the European Myeloma Network Trial Group. He also is a leading several multidisciplinary projects on molecular biology, pathogenics of multiple myeloma, and the development of biological markers to predict clinical outcomes. He is also well published in over 100 publications in peer-reviewed journals, as well as numerous abstracts and several textbook chapters. And in recognition of all his significant accomplishments, Dr. Palumbo was recently given the award by the International Myeloma Foundation, Myeloma Research and Patient Care. International Myeloma Foundation honored him with the 2014 Robert A. Kyle Lifetime Achievement Award. So obviously that is, and I had to cut a lot of stuff out too, Antonio, I got to tell you. You just seem to be one busy guy, and so thank you so much for taking the time to visit with us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Okay. So welcome to the CURE panel, and with spending per patient in the United States at twice that of the European Union, and the European Union having an average survival rate as good or better than the U.S., I would say that Europe does more with less. So today we want to discuss the European perspective on multiple myeloma with you, Doctor, and learn more about the European myeloma model. Now, at ASH and ASCO, it appears that there's cooperative relationship between researchers throughout the world with a large degree of commonality, yet there also seems to be differing views on treatment protocols. Would you outline what these differences in treatment are and why there are differences? For example, Dr. Hari mentioned U.S. and EU have similar patient populations, but EU performs 7 times as many allo transplants for myeloma. In addition, the U.S. uses the auto transplant, but in only 18.6% of patients. I would have thought myself that it was greater than that, and I was wondering if Europe does more than that, and if the transplant early or late is a backbone therapy, you know, why isn't it significantly more than this, and maybe in the 60 to 80% range? Would you
comment on this? Yes.
Talk on these subjects, Doctor.
Yes. Well, I would say first that the collaboration between EU and US is very important, and I think all the achievement has been made until now has been mainly due by an international effort, especially for this type of rare disease. An international collaboration is essential, and I think we learn from both sides of the Atlantic something one from the other. From a clinical perspective, I would say the first message is that myeloma is a rare disease. And especially for patients, the first message is you should ask how many myeloma patients a given doctor is seeing every single year, because this is making the major difference. Of course, a center where they can see more than 100 patients per year do have a completely different experience and approach from a center who might say see only 5 patients per year. So the first important and general message for patients is go in centers where a given center or physician is seeing at least 100 patients per year. Otherwise, the risk is that you are seeing a wonderful physician, but once again, the professional attitude is coming from exercise. And exercise needs a number of events that cannot be so few, and unfortunately, to some extent, fortunately, myeloma is a rare disease, so it's not so easy to have a wide experience. This, I would say, is the first issue. The second issue is probably related to the fact that, to some extent, the world is going towards a more specialty approach. And before, we were mixing all the oncology, mixing together hematology and solid tumors. With time, we are trying to separate oncology from hematology, and even in a very specialist center, we are moving to even a disease specialist. A myeloma specialist, a lymphoma specialist, a leukemia specialist, and so on. So, generally speaking, of course, going to a disease specialist might be better, but I don't think this is essential. What is essential is being in a center where the experience is of at least 100 patients per year. Having said that, which is the last question was on transplantation. I would say that as allogeneic transplantation is concerned, this is not really a standard for multiple myeloma. Today, the indication for allogeneic transplant is, first of all, within clinical trials, so cannot be considered a standard of care. Second, it might be used in very young subjects, younger than 55 or 60, in early relapse, first, second relapse after diagnosis. Not the use of allogeneic transplant is not suggested today at diagnosis, of course, outside clinical trials. As autologous transplantation is concerned, this has been a huge discussion within the international community. Europe has been always more in favor of autologous transplantation. US, to some extent, has been more reluctant to the use of autologous transplantation upfront at diagnosis. Today, we already have two randomized studies clearly showing the benefit of autologous transplantation at relapse instead of keeping these procedures later on, autologous transplantation at diagnosis instead of keeping this approach for relapse. So today I think there is a clear indication for the use of autologous transplantation at diagnosis. One of the major findings of these studies was that only 50% of patients who collect stem cells at diagnosis, they did really receive autologous transplantation at relapse for several reasons, comorbidities, different indication, but the first information is autologous transplantation at relapse can be delivered in the best possible condition only in 50% of patients. And therefore, we certainly lose the opportunity of autologous transplant if we delayed this procedure after diagnosis. The last issue will be that these studies did show both improvement in remission duration and overall survival. So today, with the available information, the evidence is that autologous transplantation must be delivered at diagnosis.
So what is your percentage in the EU? Ours is 18.6.
No, we are 50%. We are 50% because, let's say, we had a study in the UK, actually. This is an incidence that is basically coming from UK, so we do not have really numbers coming from all over Europe. The issue is that in Europe, we might say that around 50% of patients do receive autologous transplantation at diagnosis. You might consider that around 15 to 20% of them they do not receive it for comorbidities, because of course you need to be in good clinical condition to receive a transplantation. Another around, if you want, generally speaking, 15-20% of patients do not receive it for a geographical condition, because of course to receive an autologous transplantation you need to be in the big centers. If you live in a small town far away from big town, from big cities, it's maybe not so easy to find a transplantation unit. And the last 15-20% is probably related to physician attitude, might not suggest or consider this opportunity for those patients at diagnosis.
All right. We have the FDA in this country. And it seems to us that drug approval process goes at a snail's pace. In the EU, you have the European Medicines Agency, or the EMA. And is it more effective, do you think, than what we have here in the U.S.?
No, it's much, don't worry, it's much worse. This is a minus here. You see, probably from a general point of view, the plus of Europe is that the treatment is more homogeneous. There is more public institutions. Everybody is receiving the same treatment. So there is more homogeneous treatment approach. The minus is that certainly is much more bureaucratic. So, for example, drugs such as carfilzomib that you do have in U.S. Is not yet available in Europe. And on top of that, probably also, you know, some economical constraint in Europe is also reducing the opportunity to receive given drugs mainly for economical reason. Of course, the situation in Europe is different from U.S. because in Europe, generally speaking, the drug are free for all citizens. So what for you is a private insurance and therefore is based on the contract between the subject and the insurance here, the contract is between a nation and the reimbursement. So a given nation might decide to reimburse a drug, another might not consider the drug cost effective and will not reimburse the drug. So here is a more a state-based insurance approach.
So even though the EMA may approve it, it may not be approved by the nation?
Well, no, the process is, you should know, is, let's say EMA, EMA is equal to FDA. They both evaluate that the drug is effective and not toxic, period. Then every single nation has a given insurance from your side, might decide that they do reimburse that drug, they do not reimburse their drug, they limited the indication for that given drug. So then the nation, as for you, the private insurance, will decide when and how to reimburse a given treatment.
I see. When I view Europe, I see that you are one of the thought leaders, in, as a matter of fact, in myeloma. And as a matter of fact, I think of you, and I hope you take this as a compliment, as the Bart Barlogi of Europe.
Not really. Bart is... Well, Bart has many, you know, he did really a lot in U.S. He's changed completely the way to think.
Also, Pat Killingsworth just had a blog post, an article on his blog that said that arguably you are the best myeloma specialist in Europe. But in the U.S., I see a disparity between the best institutions, and you mentioned it about the 100-patient requirement that you see as a necessity, that the best institutions have newly diagnosed life expectancies of 8 to 10 years or more versus the average of both the U.S. and EU, which is about 4 years. Do you see the same experience in Europe? That the best institutions provide life expectancies 2 to 3 times that of the local oncologist?
This is Jack. The only thing I would do is to try to clarify with respect to transplant percentages, are you talking about all transplant-eligible patients, that it's either 18% or 50%, or is that of all myeloma patients?
Well, our 18.6...
They are only transplant-eligible patients.
Thank you.
Okay, and what percentage of the total patients would that be, Dr. Palumbo?
The total patient would be 30%.
Yeah.
Okay, our transplant.
From a pure age point of view, would be 30%.
Yeah, so it's closer than you think.
Yeah, it thanks, Jack. It definitely is closer.
So on the total patient would be actually 15, so.
Okay, then it's very similar. All right, what I'd like to do now is you had already mentioned that the best institutions, you pretty much answered my third question, that the best institutions generally have significantly better life expectancies than those of the average. And I was just asking whether that was the same in Europe. So let's go on to the questions now. Jack, your question?
Well, I have a couple of them. Dr. Palumbo, I'm always appreciative of your focus on quality of life, and that was evident again at this past ASH when you presented results of the efficacy of getting carfilzomib once a week instead of twice a week. And I think that might be a very important trial for patients, considering the big difference of, you know, going into an infusion center once a week instead of two consecutive days as required now. Along those lines, could you say more about the categories of fit, unfit, and frail patients, what that means, and what that might mean in terms of treatment recommendations?
Well, thank you very much for the question. I would say, generally speaking, the first issue is yes, carfilzomib is probably moving from a twice-weekly infusion to a weekly infusion, and probably, of course, we have to finish the study, but this might represent an equivalent efficacy with, of course, a more friendly approach and an improvement in terms of quality of life, of course, avoiding to go to the hospital twice a week. From the fit, unfit and frail, I think that's a very important issue that should become really a standard in every single center, which is the definition. Over the age of 65, we start to sequence of comorbidities might increase dramatically with age. So the issue in few words is, first, age by itself, and the cutoff is around 80 years of age. So someone in perfect clinical condition at 81 years becomes an unfit person. The second is the presence of comorbidities, and I would include within the comorbidities, of course, lung abnormality, heart abnormality, renal abnormality, or liver abnormalities that are not due by myeloma but are pre-existing. So subjects with these abnormalities do have higher risk of adverse events during treatment and should be treated with a low-dose intense approach in order to reduce the risk of toxicity. The third issue is what I call the leg of each of us. With time, our mobility might be reduced. So for me, to walk, to go to an hospital, to drive, might start to represent a limitation. And this is something to take in consideration when we decide which is the most appropriate therapy. Because, of course, a oral administration at home or a twice-weekly infusion might also take in consideration which are my mobility capability. And the third is also important, is my how is my mindset. some is not well known, but 50% of subjects over the age of 70 are unable to take properly the treatment has been administered at all, because they forget it, because they don't recall which pills has been taken or not. And this is another important issue to put in the evaluation, because of course how I'm able to follow my prescription, to do exactly what I should do, is very important to have an effective treatment. So I would say there are these four major evaluation to perform, and one is age, very simple, presence of major comorbidities, mindset, and mobility.
Thank you. Can you answer, it's my impression that clinical trials, recruitment to clinical trials, is seemingly more difficult in the U.S. than it is in countries like Italy and France. Why is that, if I'm correct?
This has been always a big question for me too, but basically the answer is a mix of different approaches. Here, the healthcare system is mainly public, and to some extent there is more trust in the healthcare system, because as a public employee, my interest in deliver A versus B is very limited. You know, my salary is absolutely unchanged by the type of treatment of what I'm doing. So this is from one side. From the other side, being a public official is giving to a higher rank that what we suggest is the right thing to do. I think this is to some extent one of the reasons. The other is a different attitude in the population between EU and the US. You are more used to do by yourself. You have to define what is the best thing to do. We delegate much more to someone else, that is the public, our big papa. He's going to take care of us, suggesting which is the school, suggesting which is the healthcare, giving us a pension. So we tend more to delegate to other our major choices. Probably in the future we'll get very close to the U.S. attitude. I think we are seeing a shift towards the U.S. attitude, but today this might still be considered a difference.
Thank you. And the last is a very quick question. Why does it, not that we like steroids at all, but why does it seem like the steroid of choice in Europe is prednisone rather than dexamethasone or dex as it is in the U.S.?
Now, can you repeat it? No, we use prednisone instead of dexamethasone. This is the...
Yeah.
Well, actually, this is mainly for historical reasons. We are coming from methylene and prednisone story, so there is, a use of prednisone that is more pronounced than in U.S. I have to say that once again, dex should be considered choice number one for a younger patient, while prednisone is certainly a more gentle approach and certainly gives a major advantage in the, once again, elderly frail population. 40 milligrams of dexamethasone is not a piece of cake. Pressure might be increased. Diabetes, sleep problems might come. It's a pretty intense deliver. So to some extent, prednisone, I would say, is a more gentle approach.
Thanks so much for all you do for patients, Dr. Palumbo. Dr. Palumbo,
well,
that's it for me, Gary.
Thanks, Jack. What I'll do is I'll have Lizzie Smith next online. Lizzie, your questions?
Hi. So I'm still very fascinated by the role of allotransplant for myeloma. Because it seems to be curative, I'm just wondering your thoughts on why it's not more commonly used as an approach to fighting this disease.
Because allogeneic transplant is, you know, with time, we are, you know, years ago, we were having a sort of chemo that was basically a really toxic agent and nothing else. We are starting to have more, we call it, intelligent or smart drug that are really affecting the mechanism of growth of the tumor. So this is the change that we have been seeing, and we will probably see even more in the future, looking at the therapy of 20 years ago and the therapy of today, which is the limitation of allogeneic transplant. Basically, allogeneic transplant is an immunotherapy because you are infusing in a given subject lymphocyte and antibodies where you do not know anything. At the end of the day, the issue is you might create an immunotherapy against myeloma, and bingo, this is certainly a success. But you can also infuse and deliver an immunotherapy against the host. And then when you see the graft versus host disease, when you see a risk of death that is still 10-15% within the first 100 days. So the issue is for allogeneic transplant, we do not know what we do reinfuse. If you create a major graft versus host, or a graft versus myeloma. The balance of these two options are basically making no difference in comparison to autologous transplantation. Randomized studies comparing autologous transplantation versus allogeneic transplant do see in some studies advantage for allo, in other studies advantage for auto. When you put all together, there is no major advantage of one procedure versus the other. So the evidence today, and that's why we do not suggest it, from a pure clinical point of view, is that on general population, we cannot say that allo is better or auto or vice versa. On a single subject, I call it the Russian roulette. We might infuse a major graft versus myeloma bone marrow, and this is a plus, or a major graft versus host, and this is a minus. Unfortunately, we are totally unable to predict these two options.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Pat, your question?
I'm back. Sorry about the glitch, Gary.
Yeah, sorry, doctor, that we did have a glitch. Pat?
Press the wrong button on a phone I don't use very often. Hello, doctor.
Hi.
I, too, had questions about using allogeneic transplantation in Europe, but I think you answered that very well. It would be nice if we knew how it would turn out, wouldn't it? Because I have a number of friends, including Jack on this broadcast, who have lived a long time after undergoing an allogeneic transplant. So it's always hopeful for those of us that are late-stage patients thinking if we could have done something like that, maybe we'd be around a little longer.
Maybe in the future, but today, unfortunately, especially for myeloma, maybe different for other diseases, but especially for myeloma, we are substantially unable to predict which would be the outcome of our infusion. So,
sure. And I, from your previous conversation, I understand that you have access to Kyprolis, carfilzomib.
Oh, we don't actually.
Oh, you don't.
Yeah, this was one of the differences.
So you must not have access to pomalidomide yet.
No, pomalidomide, yes, not yet Kyprolis.
Interesting. Here it was the other way around.
Yeah, of course, because this is sometimes may happen, because the criteria to approve those drugs sometimes do change from FDA to EMA, and sometimes this is happening. So sometimes we have a faster approval in Europe, sometimes it's exactly the opposite.
Interesting.
But, on average, it takes longer.
Here with Kyprolis, they're finding that by increasing the dose is helping the efficacy, or whatever, what the FDA approved. They're increasing that dose, and they're increasing the efficacy, and then I listened to you say that you're going to once a week infusions?
Mm-hmm.
Is that at a higher dose,
No, you are touching an argument that is under investigation. So I cannot give today a clear answer, which is the issue.
Understood.
If you compare 27 versus weekly, probably is absolutely the same, even probably even better the weekly. If you start to use higher doses of twice weekly carfilzomib, that is probably to be seen if they are absolutely identical. And this is issue number one. But issue number two is also another one. If you give weekly for a longer period of time, probably might be equal to twice weekly. Because you cannot, you know, instead of giving, to make you an example, 10 in 1 month, if you give 5 in 2 months, you basically might achieve the same efficacy. So putting everything together, I would say today, with 27, I would probably be comfortable to say that you are in the same range. For higher dose, I think we need more data.
Of course, of course. Are you finding that the Kyprolis is helping some patients that have become refractory to Velcade?
Absolutely, yes. Kyprolis can be used in around, I would say, 25% of resistant patient might have a clinical benefit from the use of Kyprolis.
Good. That's good news. And are you still using thalidomide often instead of Revlimid, or is that starting to be substituted now?
It's starting to be substituted and has been recently approved the use of RD up front, so I think we will substitute MPT with RD finally.
Sure.
So methylprednisone and thalidomide with Len and Dex.
Interesting. Very helpful, Doctor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. Lizzie, you've got a couple more questions, and then we'll go on to the listeners.
Hi there. There seems to be quite a lot of debate on the role of maintenance therapy in myeloma, both short-term and indefinite. What are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts are, let's put it this way, continuous therapy is absolutely needed, because if you give a treatment for 6 months and you stop it, or if you give a treatment for 18 months, there is a major difference. And the continuous treatment is improving on a median, the remission duration of approximately 1 year to 1 year and a half. So the improvement is important and has been shown in every single study. Then, not always this translates in a survival improvement, because in some studies there is a major survival improvement, in others is not. When we pull together all the available studies, there is also an advantage in survival that is not so important as the remission duration, but there is an advantage in survival. So let's say a small advantage in survival, a major advantage in remission duration. Now, the issue is, should we give an until progression or should we give continuous therapy for 2 years? This is more troublesome, and honestly, today we do not have data to clearly show that until progression makes a major difference towards 2 years of maintenance. So this is honestly an open question. The last statement I would do is continuous therapy is a plus, provided is not creating any adverse event, provided is not creating any toxicity. So in our clinic, what we do, we deliver continuous treatment until progression, although we do not have major data to say that 2 years versus until progression, there is a plus for one choice versus the other. But we certainly stop every time there is an adverse event that might hamper the use of a continuous therapy.
Okay, very interesting. Okay, do I go ahead and ask my last question?
Yeah,
Harry?
Ask your last one. Yes.
Okay. So along those lines, what do you think are some of the more promising clinical trials that may lead to a cure or at least a better long-term survival for myeloma patients? Is there anything out there that you think is, you know, really potentially groundbreaking?
Well, there are many because, honestly, today we have been using, I would say, if you want a very short answer, the monoclonals. I think we are having now several new agents coming from carfilzomib, Dioral, Ixazomib. What it will probably significantly change the treatment will be the use of monoclonals and basically antibodies that are reacting against a specific antigen present on the malignant plasma cells.
Well, thank
it may
you.
Be available pretty soon, actually, also.
Fantastic. Now, we'll go on to the calls from our listeners. Priya, would you see if anybody's online?
Yes, Gary. Listeners, if you have a question for our panel, please press 1 on your keypad, and we'll bring you live on air to ask a question. Our first caller calling in from 720-371-6410. Please ask your question. Caller calling in from 371-6410. Please ask your question. You're on air. I guess
next caller. Or I'll start.
Yes.
Submitted questions.
Gary, we can actually, I think they might have sent in the question to us already. Maybe
okay.
We could just go through the question list of questions, yes.
Sure. Doctor, we have a number of submitted questions. They're done without names. Some are, some aren't. First one, if IgG and M spike are stable, but kappa free light chains are going up, does this mean cancer is progressing?
If kappa light chain is increasing, the cancer is progressing. Of course, it depends on the magnitude of increase. So if it is an important increase, yes.
Mm-hmm. And what would an important increase be?
An important increase should be at least more than 30, 40, 50.
Okay. Ariana writes, what is the view of using Velcade prophylactically after a stem cell transplant. Her husband, now 54 but 51 at diagnosis, had autologous stem cell transplant in 2013, which was left him with 5 to 7% myeloma on biopsy post-transplant. As this is only a partial response, his consultant suggested Velcade prophylactically to increase time before relapse, and he began this in September 2013, but has made it clear that she does not know the efficacy rates.
But this is a very similar question to the previous one. Of course, you can have a continuous treatment with lenalidomide or with Velcade. They are basically similar from that point of view. One is injection, the other is oral, but basically both are effective. The issue is the moment you have a residual tumor, if there is no toxicity, is wise to use a continuous treatment to keep the tumor under control. Otherwise, if you stop, the probability of relapse will increase.
Okay. Would you suggest adding like Velcade Dex to that or thalidomide Dex?
This is we do not have evidence for this.
Right.
That Dex, I would probably start in our practice with a single agent, eventually add a second agent if I'm starting to see that something is moving. Otherwise, if everything is absolutely stable, I will keep one agent approach.
Is that a cost consideration or is that a...
No, of course, to add dexamethasone is not adding any cost. So,
right.
You know, so it's not... No, I would use a single agent. Today we do not have evidence that two agents are better than one as continuous therapy. So,
okay. How long should a myeloma patient continue a treatment such as Revlimid or Velcade? You talked a little bit about
exactly,
that.
This was the question of before. More than how long, I would stress the concept, continue if no toxicity are coming.
Okay.
Because with toxicity, stop it. We do not have any data to say that 2 years versus until progression, there is a plus of one approach versus the other. There is a U.S. studies ongoing. They will probably give us this answer. But today, we do not have any data.
And then the next question is, when you are dealing with patients that have multiple prognostic indicators for high-risk disease in particular, 17p, 1q21, and FISH13 deletion, how do you determine the most appropriate treatment regimen?
My answer is unfortunately coming from a Bart Barlogy answer. I do not have any, today we do not have any specific treatment for high-risk myeloma. You, of course, do use those intense treatment for these patients. But certainly today there is no specific treatment for high-risk patients. So we certainly use, I would say, in an autologous transplantation, I would use bortezomib induction, autologous transplantation, lenalidomide maintenance in a younger patient, and I would use once again a bortezomib-based induction, eventually followed by lenalidomide or bortezomib maintenance in a non-transplant eligible patient.
Okay, which answers the next one, which what is the role of transplant, single, two, or more for high-risk patients? So you just talked about it.
We use, of course, for high-risk, two transplant are indicated because, of course, we are certainly giving, you know, for the high risk, we give our best treatment. But we should give basically the same for the standard risk because the standard risk will do much better than high risk. So today, the answer is deliver a dose intense treatment and no specific or peculiar regimen is indicated.
Okay, but you would use a tandem?
Yeah, tandem for high risk.
Okay. Do you use a lot of tandems then?
We use a tandem in all patients.
In all patients?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So do you also use VDT Pace as well as melphalan during that? No?
No.
Okay. All right. Is that, they do that in Arkansas, correct?
Yeah. No. We use VTD because it's reimbursed. VRD is not reimbursed, so we use VTD induction, double transplant, and VTD consolidation.
Okay, so PACE would not have been reimbursed.
Yeah, it's, of course, a reimbursement issue, at least in my country. Well, all over Europe, the VRD is not reimbursed, so it cannot be used.
All right. And the next one is really the same, but with a few other things in it. 414 is: does autologous stem cell transportation have better outcomes for certain aberrations like T414, deletion of 17, T14, 16, et cetera?
No. The things are not much easier. First of all, do not pay too much attention to prognostic factor. On a single patient, the prognostic factor are not so predictive because we do not have biomarker that gives me a 95% probability to predict a given outcome. The prediction is around 30-35%. So we have one option out of two that is absolutely low as specificity in terms of predictors. Generally speaking, the conclusion is, of course, that high risk do worse than standard risk, but on a single patient, still everything can happen.
Okay. What would your treatment strategy be for a high-risk patient whose induction with RVD responded well, as it typically does, but relapse was quick, treatment with CCD are not working, meaning poor or non-responsive enough?
No, you see, for this type of patient, first of all, do a nice induction. And for them, certainly VRD induction, double transplant, VRD consolidation, probably in this patient the maintenance should be a VRD cycle every 2 to 3 months to keep the tumor under control with a dose intense continuous therapy. So this should be done certainly in terms of induction to give the maximum and prolong the remission duration as long as possible. After relapse, certainly, once again, the two options are Kyprolis plus Len or cyclophosphamide.
Okay. One thing we learned, or not learned, but one of the things that Dr. Loniel from Emory mentioned, he had some pretty good results with single transplant, but with high-risk disease, and I can't remember the induction, but
he's using exactly the approach I just mentioned before, VRD transplant, VRD, and keep going with the same schema. Today, honestly, we use that tandem. There's no evidence that tandem is superior to single. There are ongoing studies that are evaluating this issue, but honestly, I cannot say that two is better than one. Today, no one can say two is better than one or one is better than two.
Okay, and his research would indicate that.
He
was thinking, and it's not research. He just says it's supposition on his part, and the supposition was that the genetics of the high risk patient is unstable, and melphalan can aggravate that. And so, if you had higher doses of melphalan, which is a second transplant, that could be more negative than positive.
But that was the difference between Europe and U.S. We rely much more on evidence coming from study than on personal opinion.
Okay.
Generally speaking, the evidence today is that if you give autologous transplantation, in high-risk patients, it's better than if you don't give it.
That's basically a clinical trial.
We do have this evidence from trials.
Okay, and I know you've got a tremendous amount of experience with clinical trials. You've tried about everything in Italy.
No, more or less.
Yeah. Does a European perspective of myeloma treatment emphasize more of the cure of myeloma using intense multi-drug strategy aimed at complete response, or more on the control of myeloma aimed at quality of life?
The cure rate today, let's say, can be stand between 15% and 25%. So we stand more for control.
Okay. All right. An early therapy in the newly diagnosed multiple myeloma and in smoldering multiple myeloma patients, is it more advantageous or disadvantageous according to you? Is early?
Early is always more advantageous.
More advantageous. Okay. And would, could you give your opinion, and you already have a little bit, on monoclonal antibodies in treatment? And I would say, you know, is that a, you know, would it be a signal agent? It would be in combination.
Oh, it would be a combination.
Transplant.
We will basically add the monoclonal to current treatment schema.
You would add it to carfilzomib?
Yeah. The future will be that basically we will add the monoclonals to what we are using today. So RD,
okay.
VD, VRD, CRD, and so on.
Okay. Fantastic. Priya, anybody on the line?
Okay.
Okay, one other thing. Any last questions for Dr. Palumbo from the panel?
Hi, Gary. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Hi. Okay, I do have a follow-up. So, Dr. Palumbo, from the perspective of a patient who's on long-term therapy or maintenance therapy, for example, what are the risks of becoming immune to those drugs so that they no longer work? So is perhaps a better option to maybe go, if a patient is in remission, to go off of the treatment so that when a patient relapses, those drugs are still effective?
No, the balance is if you do not do anything, the risk of relapse is 70%. I'm giving just number to give you ideas. If you give a continuous treatment, the risk of more aggressive disease is 20%. So it's always true that giving a continuous treatment, you are going to chemo resistance, but it's much more prominent the risk of not doing anything and do have an aggressive, I'm not saying a relapse. So the balance is between continuous therapy that keeps the tumors under control and avoid the creation of new genetic mutation that might increase the aggressiveness of the tumor. And this is much more prominent in comparison to the risk of having anyway a genetic mutation that will make a tumor more aggressive.
Okay. That is a very good reason to stay on maintenance therapy. Thank you.
And thank you for joining us, Lizzie.
My pleasure.
You just jumped right in there like you're a pro.
Unfortunately.
And Dr. Palumbo, as I stated before, I put a list together who I thought were the great eight of myeloma specialists in the world, and you're on my list, and also very highly rated by Pat, who is a very, very, much a part of the patient advocate population. So we just thank you so much for the time that you spent with us, and for your insights and the differences, and obviously you guys in Europe do more with less, and you do more with less because you have less than half of the patient, and you do more because you don't get the drugs as quickly as we do. So the fact that your average life expectancy is as good or better than that in the United States speaks volumes for your efforts. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you for everything. Thank you for the invitation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Gary. Dr. Palomar, it has been great listening to you. Lucy, Pat, and Jack, thanks a lot. Please join us again for our next myeloma episode when we'll be discussing early treatment of myeloma with Dr. Irene Gobrial on Feb 16th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. The link for today's broadcast will be shared with all participants. Please visit curetalks.com to register for our shows. Until then, thank you.
Thanks again, Doctor.